Okay, good morning, everyone. So we saw it in the keynote. We read about it in the news every single day. It is not a secret anymore that security incidents and compromises are happening all around us. So it's not a question of if, it's usually a question of when you're going to get compromised. So who in the room? Everybody close your eyes, first off, right? We're going to talk about private, deep moments. So everybody close your eyes. Who in the room has experienced a compromise at your company? Raise your hand. Okay, so you can put them down, open your eyes back up again. It was about 25% of the room. Our statistics indicate that you're all liars. Because a compromise isn't just something that got you on the front page of the news. Keep your eyes open, because there's no shame in this one. Who has had a case of CryptoLocker ransomware on their environment? All right, so that was about the same number of hands. I'm going to guess you guys have a mission-critical application that requires out-of-date Java. Yeah. So that's a compromise, too. That is a compromise. But when we talk about those big news-making, potentially business-limiting compromises, that type of stuff, it's probably more around 35 to 45% of you will inevitably have something like that, because that's the type of landscape that we live in right now. Getting the type of malware that gets you on the front page of the news is as easy as visiting a legitimate website. So how many of your executives or grown-ups or managers or whatever you have in your environment would go to a website called Forbes? Who knows what Forbes is? Okay. This is not throwing Forbes under the bus. This is just a well-known fact. A couple of months ago, Forbes.com was hosting up nation-state sponsored malware. So all you had to do was visit Forbes with Flash installed and be from one of these 10 interesting IP address ranges, and boop, instantly, you were 100% compromised. So this is really what I want to talk to you about. I want to tell you what the malware is doing, how the compromises happen. Because the stories you're hearing, the things that you hear, the sales pitches, heaven knows there's a ton of sales pitches, buy this shiny thing and you will be 100% safe forever. That's not how it works. We want you to know how a real compromise works so that you can focus your attentions. Because when some executive at your company reads a news story, they're going to come to you and they're going to say, make it better. And you're going to look around your environment, maybe you're going to get a fine Microsoft security assessment, and you're going to say, all of this is red. What do I do? How do I start? What do I fix first? So understanding how the real attacks happen is very important to plan those strategies. So how do you usually find out you're compromised? If you attended my monitoring session last night, the answer is not by your monitoring. You usually find out, over 69% of the people who find out they are compromised find it out because an external third party, something like a government agency, calls them up and says, hey, you're compromised. Good luck with that, right? So, welcome to the worst day of your life, because this is exactly what happens. The Contoso CSO is sitting around, she's having her coffee, she's having a very good day, when a government agency known as the FIB gives her a little call, and they let her know that her IP address has been communicating with this malicious actor. Good luck with that. And then they hang up the phone. So at that point in time, the reactions that we deal with the customers usually look a little bit like this. Because deciding what to do next is really, really hard. You know that you're going to get fired, and you want to do something about it. So I am an incident responder. That is my job. How many of you, by the way, knew that Microsoft does incident response? We're getting better. We are getting better. So yes, we do, in fact, do world-class, industry-leading incident response for our customers. And we do it a little bit differently than everybody else does. But we've learned a lot from that. That's the kind of stuff I'm giving to you today. But one of the things that always bothers me is that when people think about what I do for a living, my mother, for instance, they have this concept that they get off of television and movies. And sadly, that's kind of permeated into what your bosses think cybersecurity looks like. So when they want us to figure out what happens on their network, they're thinking of what happened on a television show or a movie. So in television, it takes about 45 minutes without commercials. To figure out the infection of a single host of CryptoLocker ransomware in September of 2014, it took myself and a guy named Andrew Davis 14 hours. Yeah, I wish it took 45 minutes. And on TV, you always see the attack. And that's usually why people come to security demos. I'm going to learn attack techniques. Woo-hoo! If you are here for that, there is an attack at the end. But we never actually see the attack. We never see how a DLL sideloading attack occurred. We have to figure it out. It's sort of like, there is something wet on my head. Is it bird poop or rain? So another thing is they immediately notice the compromise on television. Whether it's something like an ATM camera or some sort of omnipotent Skynet sensor, they're going to know about it real quick. Oh my gosh, I'm being attacked. And that's not the case at all. We see very often that it's been lots and lots of time since the attack has happened, which makes my job a lot harder because all that data has rolled. And they've done who knows what on that network. So it's very different. We don't often get a very quick notification. The investigators on TV, they are in general omnipotent. They have access to everything. They can see everything. They know everything that's happening on that network. We go to a customer and we say, how many subnets do you have? How many hosts do you have? Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's very difficult because even if we have really good tools, if we can't find the Windows XP workstation that directs your airplanes landing, somebody just told me about that this morning, that there's a customer of theirs that has that. Be careful where you fly. We have to kind of piece it together. And frequently, the entrance point into the environment and then later the pivot point is some out-of-date 2003 server that they thought they decommissioned. So we may eventually start to get the breadcrumb that leads us back to it, but it's very hard to see everything that's happened on a network. On TV, they have guns. A couple of our team do live in Texas, and they are able to carry guns, but that's not usually part of our job. And another thing that there always is on a television cybersecurity show, there is always a non-naturally colored goth girl. So she's got pink hair, she drinks Red Bull, and frequently I get called her name. That's interesting. So a few statistics. Who likes statistics? Who reads the SIR? Who knows what the SIR is? All right, thank you. So the SIR, the SIR, that's our Security Intelligence Report, which we put out every 3 months? The latest one just came out today. So if you look for Microsoft SIR, you will get an amazing PDF filled with pie charts. Your bosses love pie charts. But it will tell you things like that statistic from the keynote, that 75% of attacks use stolen credentials. So if you need to understand what you should focus on first, go to the SIR. The SIR is where the data that was in Chris Jackson's session yesterday about the fact that a zero day is hardly ever used comes from. The SIR is where we get that data. What we get out of incident response, we put into the SIR that 90% of the time, the malware that got you compromised is from somebody double-clicking on it. Sophisticated attackers. Who's seen that in the headline? We say that the definition of sophisticated is they got in and the insurance company made us say this. So what you have to think about, right? Only 9% of customers who had an incident spot it by themselves. And when I talked to somebody who wrote the Verizon data breach report, he said that of that 9, only 1% actually spotted it through well-tuned monitoring. The rest of it was the adversary made a bumbling mistake, did something like tried to install 64-bit malware on a 32-bit domain controller in the middle of the day, which caused the domain controller to go down. And then they thought, who's doing maintenance on my domain controller? That kind of thing. So only 9% spotted on their own. So that means you are not alone, right? But it does mean that we need to be a little bit better about detecting it. Because that 9% was probably doing something like monitoring changes to the domain admins group or monitoring changes to the local administrators group. Or, for those of you that came to my session last night, what is event ID 1102? Clearing of the security log. T-shirt for this man. I'm so sorry, I can't throw things. There are a vast number of people who are not monitoring basic things. So if you didn't make it last night, and once I do eventually get that blog post up, we have a two lines of code to get the top five security things monitored in your environment, thanks to this man, Russell Tompkins. So the attacker is on the network an average of 200 plus days before discovery. So that's 200 plus days of being a domain admin. That's a lot of things they could do. It also means very little data for me, because often they've even formatted the workstation they came in on. Okay, I'm never gonna find patient zero. And why they're on there for 200 days is kind of a twofold thing. One, they are using your stolen credentials. Tracking your own people is hard. Bob, the domain admin, logged into a print server. Is that abnormal in your environment? Should it be abnormal in your environment? Everybody nod your head. Thank you. Okay. All right. Yeah, so if it's not abnormal in your environment, how do you know that that's not the adversary logging in and doing Google image searches for Christina Hendricks? That was in Newsweek, if you're interested in reading about it. So it's really, really hard to figure out what your own people are doing. But the other part is we lack the protective controls that serve as detective controls in the vast majority of environments. If you are not denying service accounts interactive logons to your workstations, how will you know when they do it, right? Unless you know about an attribute that you can do inside of the registry called special logon. And what does special logon do? So what it does is it will give you a specific event when people in a certain group log into your computer. So if you didn't watch Infrastructure 327 last night, go back and learn all about it. Because what you can do, though, is if you build the right protective controls, the protective controls that stop you from getting attacked, then you get denieds. And you can use those to indicate that somebody is attempting to move about your network. Because we're never going to guarantee that you're not going to lose that first soldier. There may be a zero day. There may be something like that. But you're not going to lose the war. And self-remediation, once you get attacked, is pretty much impossible. So this is not a sales pitch. But if you do get a compromise, you need help. I don't care if it's me or someone else. But you will not be able to find everywhere they are, and you will not be able to fix it. And there's a good chance that you will spend 6 heckish weeks of your life not sleeping, doing a lot of work, resetting your KRB TGT account, and doing a lot of things that the attacker is just going to go, ha, 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 and just come right back in again. So we need to know exactly where they've been, because this is how an attack typically works. I know you've seen this slide, but there's something different at the end. So the bad guy is going to target your workstations with malware. This is either going to be something like a very cleverly written spear phishing email, or maybe they're going to do that drive-by attack type of thing on the internet. And maybe he's going to use a zero day, but most of the time, he is not. What he's going to use is he's going to know a lot about your environment. He's going to know that those people that raised their hands earlier have a mission-critical application that requires out-of-date Flash or Java. So he's going to send them a very nice PDF receipt that calls an SWF file, which essentially runs a command prompt on their machine. Or the targeted phishing email may be like this. It may be a Word document. And there may be a blurred picture that looks like something you might want to unblur. And it will say, enable macros to unblur this picture. And many people happily click unblur. And what happened then is because they enabled macros, macros inside of an Office document are a command prompt. So they just happily go out and download a credential theft tool, run it in the context of that user, and that's all that happened, right? So malware doesn't have to be a zero day. It doesn't have to be like that. It can be a very cleverly constructed Word document with no vulnerability in it whatsoever. And that goes back to that, like, vast majority of things are people double-clicking on stuff. So he's going to get one of your workstations. We are never going to guarantee you that he's not going to get one. So when he gets on there, he does what's called an elevation of privilege. He uses a vulnerability in a piece of software to cause a crash in that application. And then that application, in the crashing space, it's a memory vulnerability, something like a buffer overflow or maybe a heap spray. And he's able to take advantage of a driver on the system that's spanning between user mode and kernel mode. I promise it doesn't get too geeky. But since it spans between user mode and kernel mode, he's gone from Bob surfing the internet to I'm system on your computer. Yay! So now that he's system, he can do anything he darn well pleases, which can mean harvesting your credentials. So if he wants to harvest the credentials of a logged on user, what process stores those credentials in memory? LSAS. I don't know who answered it. So the LSAS process, he will dump the LSAS process, or he can extract the local administrator password from what on that machine? The SAM database. I'm going to kill you probably with that Kinder egg. Yeah. So the SAM database is the local users on the computer. So who has matching local administrator passwords on all of their workstations? Who is not admitting they have matching local administrator password? Okay, thank you. So a lot of people raised their hands or thought about it. Because matching local administrator passwords, that means that guy, if he lands there and he dumps the SAM database as running a system, it is game over, my friends, right? So who knows about the Microsoft-supported solution for randomizing your local administrator passwords? And what is it called? LAPS. You're not getting chocolate. Everybody answered. Okay. So aka.ms/laps, and I did a Taste of Premiere video about it if you're interested. So because we want to make it a lot harder to immediately move about your network. But he's going to get somebody's creds, and he's going to use those to kind of walk about the network. So maybe he gets a help desk person, because help desk people are obviously the longest tenured, highest paid, most advanced people in your environment, so they would never click on a phishing email. And of course, you make sure that they don't have administrative access on every single workstation in your environment, right? So if he targets one of those, he has admin access to every machine in the environment. So he can then go to the domain admin's machine, do the same song and dance, steal their credentials, and then take your ntds.dit, your Active Directory database. Now, he doesn't do that because your Active Directory topology is all that interesting. I'm sure it is. But he does it because that contains the access to your squishy bits. To the data. That's what he's actually after. He's after your Exchange server, your document management systems. That's what he's after there. So if he wants to do that, there's a lot of different ways he can do it, a lot of different tools, and a lot of very sneaky ways he can do it remotely through PowerShell and leaving no forensic evidence, which really makes me sad. So it's really important that we keep those credentials off of those systems. So having a separate account for a domain admin, not having them surf the web as a domain admin, almost everyone does that now. Good job. But oftentimes, we have a domain admin surfing the web as Bob, and he's got his Bob the domain admin account, and he needs to go do some critical domain admin thing. So he approaches the left-hand side of his computer keyboard. He holds down the shift key. Then he goes to his mouse and holds down the right-hand button on it, and he clicks on the command prompt and selects run as a different user. Is that safe? No, because that is a full interactive logon to that machine. So if Bob, the regular user, happens to visit the app compat guy's amazing website and get malware, it's going to steal the credentials of Bob, the domain admin, because Bob, the domain admin's credentials are sitting in LSAS. So some of the behaviors you do may lead to you being really, really easy to compromise like this. So that's part of why we're having this lovely session. So malware. Malware is mystical and confusing. But when that guy is in there as a domain admin, he's not just stealing your data. He's putting malware all over your environment. That is why self-remediation is impossible. When we come in and we do an incident response, we're looking at maybe 50 implants. Of 10 to 20 different varieties of malware as far as an antivirus scanner is concerned. We look at them and we say, oh, that is all blah, you know, that's all high kit. But you look at them in an antivirus engine and they're completely different systems. So we have 50 or so implants in that environment. So if we're tracking down where the malware is by looking at a proxy log of what's communicating and chasing it backwards, and that malware happens to be programmed to be asleep for 6 months, in 6 months, your domain will be completely compromised all over again. So that's why self-remediation is really, really not possible, and it's very important to engage a professional and to know when to do it. So modern malware, right? So malware is very confusing. How do I get malware? How does malware work? I've got a firewall. It couldn't possibly mean that this is going to affect me. I use antivirus. Okay. So how does modern malware work? This is the height of PowerPoint animations. Are you ready for this? Okay. So this is Bob, the non-admin. He is he's hanging out. He's checking Australian rules football scores. And he gets an email. He likes this email. This email says, this is the receipt for the donation you actually made. Thank you. So he double clicks on that PDF, and that PDF actually has a flash embedded in it, and it takes advantage of a flash vulnerability or Java vulnerability for you guys. So that crashes the application. Bob doesn't think anything of it, because he's just like, oh, well, applications crash all day. I don't know what IT is doing. They're probably playing Quake. So when the application crashes, however, it extends itself outside of its own memory space. That's the goal, right? That's what a buffer overflow is. Get me out of my memory space into someone else's. And what they do is they aim for something like a driver or something that has access to system-level privileges. So a couple of the recent ones have used this vulnerability or used a vulnerability and then elevated privilege with the win32k.sys driver. I know the guy that wrote that. So the win32k.sys driver does span user mode and kernel mode, so that's why it was attractive in those things. Lots of things can do this, not just Microsoft products. I'm just talking about a very specific set of malware. So now that he is running as system, yay, he's the king. So now that he is system, he can put a service on this machine. So super legit service. That looks trustworthy, right? So it's going to be something in your services. Maybe it's named SVC host or whatever. But this is an executable written by the bad guy that starts up every time you reboot your machine. So when we talk about credential hygiene, and you're like, oh, I logged into that box. Let me just reboot so LSAS empties itself out. That's not how it works. Because that thing is hanging around all the time, capturing credentials, doing what it wants. But that service that's running there, they want not only to capture your credentials, they probably want to interact with it, right? How do these bad guys get into networks and steal data? Do they all have two-factor VPNs they've stolen from the mail? No, because what it is super legit service is going to take a packet every so often. It's going to send a packet over HTTP or HTTPS to a special IP address created just for you. Congratulations, you're special. But the reason that they do this is they've got a DNS name or an IP address that's only for a particular campaign. This means that if you're trying to do blacklisting or maybe keep track of, oh, I know that x.x.x.x is associated with name your determined human adversary of choice, I'm going to block that at my firewall. They'll be like, all right, I'm going to this nice DNS provider and getting a new name, right? So this is very hard to track down and blacklist it that way. But this is a website. This is a website somewhere out there, and it's using 80 and 443 for their ports. Since I've just told you those are highly dangerous ports, I recommend you go home and block 80 and 443 immediately. For those of you listening to the recording, that was a joke because that's what the internet uses. That's why this is really hard to track down. We're not talking about a very specific dedicated port or signature like that. We may not even be able to tell this in deep packet inspection. I've seen some really cleverly written malware where it occasionally does something that looks like getting an image or maybe surfing to a regular website or something while it's exfiltrating your data. So it's going to go out there, and it's going to take advantage of the fact that your firewalls are stateful. So a stateful firewall means I don't have to open a port to be able to receive communication. You don't have to be listening in your firewall on any port to go out to Twitter. You reach Twitter on 443, Twitter comes back to you on a random high-value port. That's how TCP works. So this takes advantage of that. Every so often, it just sends out a small little 64K packet, which means they can send packets back to you, which means you have a command prompt on the internet. That was supposed to be funny. So that's really what they are, though, is they're going to be command prompts, a remote desktop, or the ability to interact with your systems from somewhere else, right? If you've got a proxy, that's HTTP traffic. They know how to use a proxy, right? So this is very important because they can get in there, they can hide, they can put these malware in there, and they're going to be able to do whatever they want on your network. So that's malware. Okay. Everybody having fun still? All right. So when we encounter a customer and they've been contacted by external agency, they really do oftentimes just tell them good luck with that, right? Unless it's an interesting customer or something like that, or maybe, you know, of national interest. But they've got a lot of things to do, and if they don't think the data was exfiltrated, they will, however, provide them with some information. So the fictional organization called the FIB, which is based on an organization in the US that I'm sure you can't figure out, they will go ahead and give you something called a flash sheet. So a flash sheet will give you a little bit of a cheat sheet about the malware that's in your environment, the actor that's in your environment, and what's going on there. So this is really helpful because if we don't have to determine who the actor is and we don't have to waste a lot of time digging through and developing new TTPs or like indicators of attack, we can get to business a lot quicker and help you out. So the FIB has let us know that the actor known as APT-2005 or Rapid Rhino has actually infiltrated this customer because they're in the kitty litter industry vector. That's actually important to us because we have the world's largest sensor network. I did tweet it during the keynote, sending us telemetry is not scary. Because sending us telemetry from System Center Endpoint Protection, who uses that product? There's a documented blog post about how if you don't turn on the cloud and telemetry feature in System Center Endpoint Protection, you have made your antivirus product 25% worse, guaranteed. So when you see a lot of those things talking about what a terrible product SCEP is, read and see if they had that turned off. Because the telemetry data allows us to look into our ginormous sensor network, our big old big data cluster, and say, what was APT-2005 doing 1 hour ago? Because we can do that. So we want to know kitty litter industry vector. That reduces the amount of time for us to do because they like to go after all the same people. They've got some interest. They've got tasks. They've got project plans. I'm sure they've got a project manager with a clipboard. You know, their bosses have goals for them just like you do. I don't know what happens to them if they don't meet them. I don't want to think about it. So we know what we've got here, we know the attacker is, and they're going to give us some technical details about the malware itself. So this is really going to help me as I'm tracking it down in the network, because it reduces where I have to look of the 50 billion places on your computer for something if I know what I'm looking for. So CryKit, the individual who wrote this malware for me is actually an Exchange PFE, and his name is Chris, so we've called it CryKit. So it's a first-generation Trojan with full remote shell capabilities and credential theft tool sets. That's a line that says game over, right? So the full remote shell, that means that if CryKit is installed on your machine, they're going to have that command prompt on the internet. CryKit's also got the capability to steal your passwords. So it's going to be able to do things on the network, steal those credentials, whether they be hash value or not. Traffic is beaconed over HTTP and HTTPS. So, okay. That gives us something we could look at. And we have minimal identifying strings. Who knows what a string is in a program? Okay, it's a piece of text. That is actually, but the text, if we look at the strings of a piece of malware, can be really, really important to us because it will tell us what they were doing. We might find out what their command and control IP address was, that special IP address just for you. We might find out a lot of details about the malware, or we might find an identifying piece so that we can scan for it in the rest of your environment. So strings are very important as to how we can track these things down. And we know that the Trojan is installed as a service. So if I'm working backwards off of this and the information that the FIB has provided, I have a little bit of stuff that I can work with. So that's not too bad. So we know that the malicious host that was beaconed to, when the FIB called that thing that was beaconing, that was a domain controller. So if you're following along at home, how easy is remediation if your domain controller has been fully compromised? Okay, good. Because the answer is, it's not feasible. So if the domain controller was beaconing, unfortunately, that's what we know. We are working backwards from a domain controller with CryKit installed on it. So we've got to figure out how it got there, what else is compromised. I mean, the answer is everything's compromised, but we know the potential threat family. We know a lot about Rapid Rhino. We know what we're looking for. We know for those behaviors. And we've identified that host that was beaconing, the domain controller, so we know what we're looking for. So incident response tools we wish we had, right? 9 times out of 10, we go to a compromise and we want to know important stuff and they don't have it. unfortunately, I do not yet have these incident response tools. So please go watch my other session, right? Because we are absolutely reliant on the monitoring you had in place before this happened. There are a lot of really clever things that we can do with things you don't know about in the operating system, like the USN Change Journal. Maybe you know about it, but you're about to learn all about it. But if you have a good logging strategy in place, a good monitoring strategy in place, this is going to make this so much easier. So that's why we're having the conversations now, because we don't have time machines. So what tools do we use? This is another like myth about cybersecurity, is that we've got this magic tool set, and we roll in, and maybe we've got a big old Peloton case, and we hit the button that says, find the bad guy. That's not how it works. because what we actually use are a lot of the same things you would use. We use the event logs. We use the USN Change Journal. We use artifacts that are on the machine. And most of the good people on our team, they have been IT people for 10 to 20 years. They know what's normal and not normal on a system. So if you call us and you have a malware case, which if you are a Microsoft customer, you can absolutely call us and we will help you figure out what's there, we will give you a tool called WOOF. It stands for Windows Online Forensics, and it is not a verb. Okay. So WOOF, when we give it to you, is actually the world's most glorified batch file. Because all it's going to do is run a bunch of stuff that you could get off the internet anyway. It's going to gather your logs, it's going to get the USN Change Journal, it's going to get NTFS info, it's going to go ahead and get the ASAPs off of the machine, which are another very important thing for us. So who saw my tweet or can tell me what an ASAP is? Okay, you already have one of these, though. So, yes? Auto-start extensibility point. So yes, you know what the acronym means. Now, what does that actually mean for your system?
5 minutes of learning. It's locations on an operating system that malware can hook into.
So locations on an operating system that malware can hook into. So that's not bad, because it's locations where anything can hook into. So you do actually need that. I think in order to earn a t-shirt, though, you're going to have to name 3 ASAPs for me.
Okay, well, the...
name one.
Registry.
So the registry. Where in the registry?
In your run once.
So run and run once. So run and run once. We're going to pause for a second here. Run and run once were some of the first malware registry keys that people learned. Because in the early 2000s, your basic malware was sticking itself into the registry area known as run and run once. What's old is new again. 1997 is back. Because now what you can do is you can place into the run key a base64 encrypted PowerShell script so that when you open up the registry editor, you don't see that key. And every time you restart your service, restart your computer, PowerShell-based malware is starting up with it. There's a variety of it called Powelix, if you're interested in it, but there's a lot of determined human adversaries using it too. So yes, run key is acceptable. Very good. Who wants to name another one?
Services,
yes. Services are absolutely a very popular ASAP for bad guys to use. They're going to create a service. They're going to make it look clever. They're going to use a randomly generated name. My favorite randomly generated name for a malware service was the service called Helpful Beer. It seems very accurate. So they're going to try to use a service if they can. All right, who wants to name another one? Task scheduler. Were you looking when I looked at my slides earlier? Okay. So task scheduler, yes, absolutely. That is a great way to maintain persistence. Because who has ever looked through their environment and found a scheduled task called @1? Who knows how to go look for their scheduled tasks? Okay, so scheduled tasks named @1, that's using the legacy remote task scheduler, which was called @, in order to create a scheduled task. So when they do that, they're creating something that might call run DLL32 and register their malware, because a DLL is just an executable. I think I have to stop because I have to get the rest of my presentation done, but you get the idea. Okay, so dramatic pause. I am telling you how I do my job. I'm telling you what tools I use, not because I want you to do my job. If you have a major incident, please get help. I want you to understand how to start the job. I want you to understand how the malware works. but you could be in serious, serious trouble at your organization if you try to cowboy it, right? We want you to be good eyes, hands, and ears. We want you to notify us when something is wrong. If you're an Exchange guy and you start to see a crazy server with CPU going crazy and it's got a new driver on it, that's probably malware. You should give us a call. But you know, this is not for you to go cowboy. If you want to go cowboy in your labs at home, that's fine. I just want to make sure that none of you get fired from listening to me. Okay. So let's do a little bit more talk about that, why you have to do that. Band-Aids don't fix bullet holes. Yes, that's a Taylor Swift quote. Don't play whack-a-mole. Whack-a-mole is where you hit all the little things on air. We do have to watch for all of the implants. You have to know a holistic diagnosis. If you have been completely compromised, if your domain controller has been compromised, you have to do a recovery effort. Reading the past the hash white papers, reading the best practices for securing Active Directory are great, but we need to know how to fix how we got there. This goes back to the logging conversation from my session yesterday. Don't get overwhelmed by your data. And don't rely on tools. It's really important to know how Windows works and know how your environment looks. Most of what we do is art, not science. Okay, so let's forensicate. Anyone have a question at all? Yes, the question was, do I need a vulnerability at all if my people have local admin? No, because if you're dealing with something like an exploit kit that gives you CryptoLocker ransomware, the very first thing it checks is, are you admin? Here, have some malware. So no, you don't need that. Guy in the back. I'm going to translate your question to what I think works for the recording. So the question was about buffer overflows. Buffer overflow is a well-known type of memory attack. No, they're not that popular anymore. They are not that useful anymore. Data execution prevention, things like that. But I dropped that name because you might not know what ROP is, or stack pivot. So if you are interested in what type of vulnerabilities, come up. I'll give you the Emmet guide, which goes through all of them. But yes, that's not as useful anymore. That is correct. Okay. So I had a domain controller that was beaconing with malware. So let's start. Let's go ahead and look at what we would have gotten. So if we give you that fancy Wolf tool, the world's most glorified batch file, I'm going to get this data from you. So I'm going to get your security logs. I'm going to get something called the USN Change Journal. Last Kinder Egg, who knows what the USN Change Journal is? Russell Tompkins. Oh, you. So in AD, absolutely, I'm going to give it to you because you knew what it was. So the USN Change Journal is well known for Active Directory people because it keeps track of, you know, which item has changed. In NTFS, it's a record of all changes to your file system. You delete a file, you add a file, you create a file, you modify a file, I'm going to be able to see it. And this is not meant to be a forensics tool. This is so NTFS doesn't lose your files. But it's really useful for me because I can, if I don't have logs, I can see when malware.exe was dropped on your system. So I know I have a service. I know I have a service, and I know that it's been there, and it was a bad thing. Because when I know that I had a service, I looked into my machine, and they told me that I had a malicious service. So I ran auto runs, and I found out that I had a malicious service on my machine, a new machine. I don't know what just happened there. But anyway, it's called Uninterrupt Power Supply. And I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. And Uninterrupt Power Supply is actually pointing, its service is a startup thing called c:/svchost.exe. Who thinks that's where svchost should live? Always lives there. Yeah, no. So I know that, and I happen to know what the event ID for a new service being installed on my machine is because I attended Jessica Payne's fabulous session. So I know that I have 7045. So I have that in the system log as a new service being installed in the machine, and that's why you should monitor for this. Because this is malware being dropped on my machine. And now I have an indicator of when that happened, and I have a reference point in time to work backwards, because that's what we do. We work backwards in time. So luckily, they had this in the environment, so I knew. So this is a domain controller. I want to know what happened around the time that happened. If I open an event log that's been granted to me by somebody else, it actually renders the events in my local time. An important thing to know. It doesn't do it in like Greenwich Mean Time or anything like that. So I had, around that point in time, who was logging in. So who was logging in around the time that that event happened? So 9:30 and 45. And I'm actually going to scroll through these like this just to show you how boring my job is. Okay, so who logged on? I'm going to cheat because I know who it did and I'm running short on time. Oh my goodness, Bob the DA. So Bob the domain admin. That's weird because when I talked to Bob the domain admin, he wasn't working that day. Wonder what happened there. So Bob the domain admin wasn't working that day makes it a lot easier because oftentimes Bob the domain admin was working that day. So if we look in the event ID, we can see a little bit of detail about where they came in from, and where they came in from was, in this environment, a workstation. The workstation is, that's not a domain controller, that's a workstation. So we know exactly where Bob the DA logged in from, and that's not Bob's workstation, that's Steve's workstation. So we have some interesting thought processes here, and we now have a place to go and look for what happened there. But we also kind of have a question about how did that cry kit or how did that service get onto the machine? Because if we go back and we look, before that service happened, we will find that PSExec was installed on this machine. So I mentioned PSExec yesterday. It actually installs a service on the machine. So PSExec was used from that workstation to connect to the domain controller, run sccreate, and install that malicious service. Okay, it's a lot of detail right there. We good? We're going good? Okay, all right. So now, having that workstation, knowing what was happening on that workstation at that point in time, I'm going to go and I'm going to look at the USN change journal. So I've got the auto runs up here. This is how I found the uninterruptible power supply. But the USN change journal is going to be very interesting for me because it's going to tell me a lot of details about what was happening. So here, if I go to the workstation, well, that's interesting. I can see that, zooming. All right. So this is a record of all changes to your file system. So at this point in time, Bob was playing with something on his desktop in a folder called things, because that's where all the legitimate stuff goes, called svchost.exe. Well, that's interesting. I wonder what else Bob was doing. Maybe, I can find PSExec. And I am actually having trouble with searching because I know darn well that it's in these logs because PSExec did happen. But the USN change journal is super duper helpful from that point of view because it's going to be able to tell us everything that happened on that file system. Now, it doesn't roll like a normal log. It doesn't act like a normal log, and you can't control it very easily because it's based on the size of the drive. So usually it's there for us. Usually that's very helpful, and we like it having it there. But it can go away, and it can hide itself from us what happened there. But if we do have it, we can see a lot of different stuff here because if this is the workstation, right, if I know that this is a workstation, yeah, I just saw it. I don't know why it's not searching it correctly. But here we have Bob downloading PSExec. So Bob definitely was on Steve's machine getting PSExec. So we have two sets of stolen credentials here. So we have him getting PSExec and putting it onto his desktop because he's got that create there. So we have a beginning point. We have somewhere where we know what's happening and we're working backwards from there. And that's oftentimes what we do, is we'll go ahead and we'll look through that. So we actually see this stuff right here. So if I'm looking at this USN change journal, and I happen to know that this is a workstation, and I start to see a bunch of file creates in a profile for Bob DA, that's a good indicator that Bob DA is logging onto this system for the first time. So we have Bob DA's credentials stolen and logging into this workstation. So this can give me, in my imagination land, an idea. Steve didn't get Bob DA directly. He got Bob, right? And he's using Bob to get onto this workstation, then he's using Bob DA to do the rest of his work. So we know we have two sets of stolen credentials. So they definitely got Bob in total. But this is Bob logging onto a machine for the first time and creating his profile. So we know we've got the domain admin on there at the time that we had the host connecting to the domain controller and installing the service. So now I have to figure out what the heck happened to cause those credentials to be stolen. Now, we're really shaving about 36 hours of troubleshooting time off of this, just so you know. But what actually happened there, and hopefully I can get into my domain controller to figure it out. And I'm going to do something bad here and log in as the built-in administrator. Don't do that. I just locked out my account, though. So in the domain controller, which I know is tiny, I'm going to zoom, don't worry. What we found was that when we looked at the memberships that Steve, the guy that owned that workstation, had, Steve had some interesting group membership. Because if we went to Active Directory users and computers, and we found Steve, who happens to be in this environment, just named Steve. Steve is a member of which groups? So Steve is not a domain admin. Steve is not even an administrator of the workstations in this environment. Steve did not have administrative access to his workstation. But Steve happens to be very magical, because Steve is a member of Group Policy Creator Owners. So what Steve has is the ability to link group policies to areas where workstations live, create and link group policies. So let's see what Steve does with his spare time. So if we go to the group policy, and we actually go and we look at the computer's OU, we have this lovely task. We can tell that Steve cares about his life, because he's got a cleanup task. So this looks like, you know, so Steve is definitely doing good work here. He's created a group policy, and it's called cleanup tasks. We can see that it was created by Steve. And down here, in the area here at the very bottom, you can see what this task is doing, the scheduled task. So he's got a scheduled task that's calling out to sysvol and calling a command to do some cleanup stuff. Who would stop here if they saw this in their environment? That doesn't look malicious, does it? It doesn't. I mean, don't lie just because maybe you saw me tweet the end result here. But that will stop a lot of people. It's Steve's job to create group policies. It's Steve's job to create scheduled tasks to clean things up. This is why it's a little bit difficult. So, but Steve has the ability to edit the group policy, which means Steve has the ability to write to that area of sysvol. So when we go and we look at that area of sysvol, we're going to find that not only did he create that and put that, whatever, he put that command prompt in there. So what does that command prompt do? Let's go look at the scheduled task as he has it installed on a system. So we're going to go to Bob's workstation, because we think that's where it all happened, and we find his cleanup task. Okay? So here's his cleanup task. It looks totally legit. Here's the actions. This is where it calls out to that program. So here is the program. Let's go out and look at what is in there. When you fill out your evals, I'm really, really nearsighted. So, my Hyper-V switch has disconnected. That's why I don't have access to anything. Crud. Okay. That is a command prompt that is calling what is called Windows Credential Editor. So Windows Credential Editor is credential theft software. And Bob, being a good admin, had actually logged onto this machine with his regular account. He hadn't done anything like logging on as a domain admin. But when that script, that non-malicious looking script had run there, it's actually set to log to the root of C. So in the root of C, that script that's probably just doing cleanup things. You might stop right here, right? There's just logs, right? But when we go and we look inside of log 2, we actually see the output from Windows Credential Editor. That's what that script was doing inside of sysvol. It was living there calling scripts. Steve is not a domain admin, but Steve was able to get his passwords for domain admins. Because we can see that when Windows Credential Editor ran, which it did every hour as a scheduled task, very helpful, it ran Windows Credential Editor with the W switch. And the W switch pulls out W digest authentication from LSAS. And that's plain text passwords stored in memory. So I didn't have to crack these passwords, and I already have the domain admin's password right there. So that is how Steve got the passwords, because Bob held down the shift key on his keyboard, right-clicked, and ran as a different user on his Active Directory users and computers, which exposed those credentials and made it possible for this to happen. So this is why it's really, really important that you understand what types of logons you have in your environment, and more importantly, that you make sure that you are denying high-value credentials from logging into places. Because if you go into the tool, I know it'll cost you a lot of money, it's called Group Policy. Okay, so inside of Group Policy, there's something called Deny Interactive Logon. If you set the Deny Interactive Logon, link a GPO to your workstations, and put domain admins in there, this would not have happened. Because when he tries to do that shift, right click, run as a different user, he would be denied access to that system. So there's lots of different ways that this malware works. There's lots of different things that it can do on your systems. There's lots of ways that it can get there. But fundamentally, most of what happens is because of credential hygiene issues. So if you're having difficulty understanding where to start, it is very important that you start with the credential hygiene part, because then they won't be able to get to that domain admin level thing. They won't be able to immediately move about your network and do absolutely everything that they want to do there. I'm going to try to get my network working to show you something even cooler, so I will take a question. Anyone have a question?
How do you stop that right-click run as a user?
You go into group policy. So how do you stop right-click run as a different user? Yeah.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
Without doing that, if you rely on doing that, what's the solution?
So rephrase the question.
So
this is an important question. So the question is, my administrative behavior that I do in my environment right now is when I need to do administrative tasks, I do shift, right click, run as a different user. What should I be doing instead? The answer is that you should have a physical separation between your administrative credentials and your regular credentials. This sounds really crazy, I know, right? But you don't need administrative access to keylog. You don't. There's a cross-site scripting keylogger. So if you're typing your domain admin credentials into a workstation that you web surf on, I do sleep with 7 layers of tinfoil on my head, just so you know. But this is a real world scenario. We want a physical separation between where you type your domain admin credentials. And that's not as hard as it sounds, because there's this thing called virtualization. So turn your virtualization ideas upside down. Don't have an admin VM, have an admin machine that's denied access to everything. You use AppLocker, you do application whitelisting, you lock this thing down, you make it functionally useless and really annoying. And then on there, you have remote app, Azure remote app, hopefully. Thank you. Where you actually have that running Internet Explorer, Firefox, Outlook, whatever you're doing. So all of the dangerous stuff is actually happening on Microsoft servers. And then when you do get malware, it's not going to do that. Because malware has a really easy time of breaking into a VM. It has a harder time breaking out. As a matter of fact, a lot of malware wants to defeat the researchers. So if you're a VM, it'll say, I'm not even executing. Thanks so much. Right? So privilege admin workstation strategies are really important to us. And aka.ms/pth, the pass the hash portal, the link is broken right now, but we're fixing what it points to. It just points to white paper right now. But our credential theft portal, we're going to put guidance for how to build privilege admin workstations coming soon. Because buying secondary hardware and carrying around 2 laptops isn't feasible for everybody, but it's really important to have that secondary separation. If you can't do that now, You can start to implement credential hygiene using jump servers or terminal servers, but you have to understand there is no security boundary between a terminal server and you, as far as we're concerned. Those credentials could still get stolen. If you would like to hear all about credential hygiene and how to stop it, aka.ms/TOPPOPSLAM, where I talk about it for 38 minutes. Or you can hit me up afterwards. But yeah, it's a really, really hard thing to do because you think you're doing the right thing. You believe that you are doing what you need to do in order to keep those credentials safe, and it's hard to break that behavior. The best practices for securing Active Directory white paper, Laura Robinson actually lists out a lot of the correct admin behaviors in there too. This is the hardest part though. The technology of security is really easy. For group policy settings, who thinks that they'd have a hard time with that? The answer is no. Okay. Going to 50 different SQL Server administrators and telling them they can't run SQL Server Management Studio from their laptops anymore. Who thinks that's easy? You know, so it's going to be the politics, it's going to be the workflow changes in the organization that makes it very hard, which is why we talk a lot about start with your domain admins. A domain administrator account is for administering the domain. It's easier to separate that out and then work your way down through the tiers. Yeah. Okay. I believe the session's over at 12:45. Does that sound right? Okay. All right. So super legit task. I'm in a task scheduler here. So if I go to super legit task, this is actually an even cooler way to do what was happening. Once again, I've got a scheduled tasks, but I'm going to use the new hotness. I'm going to use pretty much undetectable evil, right? So what do I have here? I have a scheduled task. Let's take a look at the scheduled tasks. Because if I look at the actions of the scheduled task, who knows what I'm doing yet? Okay. All right, so if I look at the actions of that scheduled task, it is calling PowerShell. So if I look at the PowerShell that it is calling, it's actually doing a web object. And the web object that it's calling, if I can get it out of there for you guys so you can actually see it on these tiny screens. Okay, somebody giggled. So it is going out to the internet to a shortened URL, and it is running a PowerShell script called invoke-mimikatz. So Mimikatz is a credential theft tool. It's incredibly awesome. But what it's doing is it's doing it via PowerShell with a DLL sideloading attack. So when I go and I look in the logs, there's absolutely nothing. If you are running default versions of PowerShell 2.0 and all the ones that are in 2008 R2, there's absolutely nothing that will even show you this happened. So they're able to steal those credentials and dump them to awesome.log. Now this is actually on Steve, the guy who has absolutely no administrative access in the environment's machine. And we can see that we have awesome.log there, and the formatting's kind of funny, but you can see that we do in fact have credentials that are pumped into there. We have the passwords of the computer and the user. So this is understanding why it is so important to actually have that separation in order to keep those credentials there, because it's really easy to lose them. Steve did not have administrative access on any computer in that domain, and Steve was a domain admin within 15 minutes or so. See, I told you I would show you attacks. So the question is why can't my regular old end users run Mimikatz? If you notice that scheduled task, it was actually running a system. That's why we did it as a scheduled task. We ran it as a system. So your regular old end user, unless they have figured out a vulnerability and elevation of privilege, would not be able to do that type of thing. Your regular old end user, however, would be able to take a computer that does not have full disk encryption, boot it from a Microsoft product called Dart, reset the local administrator password, and then dump all of the administrative passwords on your machines. So it is entirely possible to get those credentials without administrative access, physical key loggers, physical attacks, new vulnerabilities. But you know, the idea here is not to worry about the vulnerability of the week. Don't make this all about pass the hash. Don't make this all about NTLM. There is life after NTLM. We want you to build security strategies that are robust and stand up against all of the new attacks that happen. That's what that's about. So, monitoring strategies, I did a whole session on this yesterday, INF327. There were some technical difficulties, but yeah. We need to have centralized logging. We need to know that we have the right things enabled. We need to know the dangers of PowerShell logging. get your PowerShell upgraded. It shows it a lot better. There's a new tool, a new sysinternals tool called Sysmon. Sysmon is a service that runs on your computer, creates a new event log, and if you ran invoke-mimikatz, it would have a log entry that said, Jessica ran invoke-mimikatz. It is not something that you're going to be able to alert on. There's a lot of data. It's spammy, but look into it because it'll help a forensic iter. Windows 10. Windows 10 has a unified scripting host. So if you have Windows 10, I will be able to tell that you ran invoke-mimikatz. And advanced threat analytics can detect some of the attacks, like pass the hash and things like that. So you can look into that. If you have EMS, you already own it. So the defensive strategies, ride around on Tyrannosaurus Rex. Credential theft mitigations. I know it's boring. I know you're tired of hearing Microsoft people talk about it. But we do need to create reference architectures, because single sign-on is why this all works. Single sign-on is why we can steal your credentials. So would you like us to turn off single sign-on? Okay, cool. So we need to build some credential theft strategies, and that's where the Pass the Hash white papers do. Network and application segmentation. Azure Remote App, I tweeted about it during the keynote. If you're not familiar with that, you can have on-prem remote app too. This is a feature in a terminal server where you take your mission-critical application with out-of-date Java that causes you to get CryptoLocker ransomware. You put it onto a terminal server, so it's running in a very, very locked-down environment. The only website it can get to is that out-of-date Java-needing website. And then you publish it as a remote app, which is an MSI, which you deploy to your end user's workstations, and there's an application on their desktop to them. It looks and it says out-of-date application, but it's really a remote app. You need to do terminal server lockdowns, but you can immediately reduce your attack footprint by getting those out-of-date software off of there. Emmet, Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. If you don't know about Emmet, we've got a couple talks up there on Channel 9 about it. Hit me up if you have questions about it. But it stops that memory-based exploit protection so that you don't get that initial buffer overflow or whatever that causes you to get system-level access. And that well-implemented cloud solutions. This is not just a sales pitch. Do your cloud, do it right, and you can make sure that you're not going to have the vulnerabilities in your network that lead to the overall credential theft. And unlike TV, not guns. I'm sorry. It's really hard to shoot the bad guys there. So that is it. And that is, I've actually completed on time this time, which is nice, I think. Did I do it on time? All right. So thank you so much for attending. I'll be around for a little bit if you have any questions. And I do have an empty blog and a Twitter where I'll be posting a lot of these things there. Thanks so much, guys.